You'd open up to Isaiah chapter 5. Last week we saw in the parable of the vineyard that God could in no way be blamed for the coming judgment on the people of Judah. I mean, what more could he have done, as he explained? He set forth. The reality was that the choice vine that he planted, that he cultivated, that he protected, it ended up, contrary to his expectations, it ended up producing rotten, stinking fruit. In our section today that we're going to look at, the prophet goes on to deliver six stinging indictments against the specific sins of the people. These are perversions that are especially shocking when we understand that the guilty party is not some pagan nation. The guilty party, again, is God's choice vine, is his own elect people, the chosen people of God. So he introduces each of the descriptions, these six woes that he's going to declare, these six indictments. He introduces each one with this word woe, as he's going to show what the nature is. This rotten, stinking fruit that he said is what was produced, he's now going to detail what that was. And he goes through it. The structure of this passage is you can't miss it. I mean, it's just each segment starts off with that one exclamation of woe. The Theological Word Dictionary of the Old Testament says this word woe, it's an interjection. It's usually used of lamentation in the context of mourning, in the context of death. It occurs 50 times in the prophets, this word woe, and only once elsewhere. So it's something that the prophets use to get your attention, to startle you into listening, and to tell you the gravity, the severity of the situation. It involves usually some type of negative warning or threat of God's impending judgment, as it does in our passage in Isaiah chapter 5. Really, you could translate it almost how horrible it's going to be. You know, what dreadful things are going to come about. It's the opposite of the word blessed that you see in the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount. This, instead of blessed, are those. This is woe that's coming upon these people. So judgment is coming, is the word of Isaiah. Judgment is deserved. It's not God's fault. And judgment will be a devastating work of the Holy One of Israel. Let's read verses 8 to 23. Woe to those. You can follow the six woes here. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones, without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening, that wine may inflame them. Their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. Therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished. Their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure, and Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the common man will be humbled, and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So after he introduces these first two woes, now he comes in rapid fashion with the remainder. Doesn't speak so much of the judgment, just lists basically the sin that's involved. So he says, verse 18, woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood, and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. six woes declared against six perversions in this passage. Most of us are probably familiar with what are called the seven deadly sins. You know, they're listed as wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, gluttony. Some of those are covered here, but this passage isn't as famous, dealing with the six condemned perversions, what I call them. But they're along the lines of these seven deadly sins. They're equally pervasive. So just as the prophet is trying to get the attention of the people of Judah, the people of his day, to warn them, to try to motivate them to turn from their sinful ways. The only hope they have is casting themselves upon the mercy of God. So I think we need to listen to the voice of the prophet in our context in the United States. These, as we think of how specific he's going to get with the sins that are involved here, there are things which characterize our country. So as we get into this study in Isaiah, you know, why do we go back and study something in the Old Testament? It's directly relevant to our situation in the United States today. This same message could be and is being proclaimed today to us. It's sobering. So we think it's the same rotten, depraved hearts that we have in our country. So these things stem from the same source. They stem from the same heart condition. It doesn't matter. They're not stemming from who's in charge in terms of the government. They're not, you know, it doesn't depend on, you know, what our economic status is in our country. The problem is people's hearts, which are the same. And the heart condition in our nation, we have become an apostate nation. You know, a nation that had such a preponderance of Christian values and godly men in its heritage now has largely become an apostate nation, just as the nation of Israel has. So it should be sobering for us to study this today, because God is not mocked. Whatever a person or a nation reaps, that is what, whatever a person sows, that's what will be reaped, whether it's a person or whether it's a nation. So our apparent prosperity, we look around and we say, is God going to continue to bless a nation that continues to go down this path of apostasy? Isaiah says no. Isaiah says don't have that expectation. The sobering thought is that God will come in judgment in his time. What this teaches us in this section in Isaiah, the society that's on the verge of experiencing God's severe judgment, it reflects these six condemned perversions that we're going to study this morning, that rotten, stinking fruit of an apostate people. It was evidenced in Judah, and it's evidenced today in our land as well. So we'll begin in verses 8 to 10 and see this first woe here against the perverters of possessions, those that are characterized by greedy materialism, those that are interested in empire building. They're characterized by covetousness, by selfish ambition. It says, woe to those who add house to house and join field to field. Well, isn't that just smart capitalism? I mean, isn't that just using the resources that God has given you to grow and to prosper as God would want you to prosper? Apparently not. In the context here in Israel, God had given very specific instructions about how he had committed the land as a stewardship to the families involved. And he didn't want that land transferred over and accumulated by just a few wealthy landowners. He wanted that land to stay in the stewardship of the various families in terms of how it was distributed. That's why there were specific laws regarding the year of Jubilee, when you could be released from your debts and obligations and things could be restored to its former state, so that even if by virtue of some heavy obligation you had had to sort of mortgage your property for a time, it was only supposed to be a temporary situation. And the land was supposed to stay distributed as God had intended for it to be, so that you would all have your place in which to grow, in which to develop and experience God's blessing. But what had happened was that people had gotten greedy. They weren't content with God's provision for them, but instead they wanted to build their empire. They could never be satisfied. They could never have enough. And so they added house to house, and they added field to field. And so these were people that were covetous. That, you know, if you looked at their value system, it was one of how many possessions can I acquire for my own enjoyment, for my own security. My security is not that you know, we pray that God would provide our daily bread each day. No, my security is I'm gonna provide for myself and lay up everything so that I can look around and my future is secure because of what I own and what I possess. And so they had their hearts in the wrong place when it came to faith and trust and contentment. You think over in 1 Kings chapter 21. We won't turn there, but that's the story of King Ahab and his wife Jezebel. And remember that King Ahab looked around and he saw that vineyard that Naboth had. You know, King Ahab had all, you know, he had all of his wealth, and here he looks at this poor vineyard next to him that this man Naboth has, and he covets it. He wants to have it, and he's downcast because Naboth won't sell it to him. And so Jezebel says, well, I'll take care of it for you. And so she concocts this scheme where false witnesses rise up against Naboth, accuse him unjustly, have him condemned, have him stoned to death, so that then King Ahab and Jezebel can take ownership of that property. And we see Elijah dispatched to speak to the king and confront him with his sin of materialism and of covetousness. He was one that was in the context and the time frame of Isaiah here, he was a prime example of this spirit of perverting possessions, of wanting to just take ownership of what wasn't his. Amos chapter 3, verse 15, God says, I will also smite the winter house together with the summer house. The houses of ivory will also perish, and the great houses will come to an end. You have accumulated all of these various houses. You can't even live in them all. They're just all over the place. And you've done it from a wrong motivation. Your heart motivation isn't to use these as a stewardship for God. It isn't to bless others. It's to bless yourself and to line your own pockets. And so God speaks in terms of judgment. In all of these sins, as you go through each of these six woes, there are always unintended outcomes and consequences that the foolish people don't realize as they enter into whatever the path they go down of perversity. As they enter into that, what they don't realize is that there are consequences for their actions, and God is going to bring these about. In this case, it speaks back in Isaiah chapter 5. It says, you do this, you join field to field until there is no more room so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. That's interesting. Now you're bereft of any companionship. You don't have any neighbors. You now have this loneliness and this isolation, which really speaks to, if you look at the people in our culture that have amassed great wealth, often if you dig into their family lives and dig into, you know, how they really function in life, they're among the loneliest people around. They can't trust people. They feel that others are taking advantage of them. They know that they've been taking advantage of other people. They're suspicious in the same way that, well, other people must be taking advantage of me. They can't, they just are cut off from the type of love that they would like to experience, and they end up in a state of a Howard Hughes type of, you know, isolationism. And that's what God speaks of here, is you have basically put yourself in this condition. Sometimes it's good to, on each of these sins as well, a nice track would be to go through the book of Ecclesiastes and see what Ecclesiastes has to say in some of these areas as well. It speaks to the futility of trying to amass possessions. And Solomon went down that route, and he was a prime one that experienced so much, and he had so much wealth and so many possessions, and yet his message was one of futility and vanity and emptiness apart from faith in God and obedience to Him. So sometimes the man who has everything really has nothing when it comes to the hole and the vacuum in his heart that's not met. And again, that lack of contentment. And so there's this unintended outcome and consequence of loneliness. And then there's the divine judgment. In each of these sins, there's divine judgment. Whether it's spelled out or not, it is with the first two woes here. It's made very specific as to what God's going to do in response. And the Lord, it says, He almost whispers in the ear of Isaiah. It says, He has my ear. He communicates into my ear what He's going to do in response. He's the Lord of hosts. He's the one who controls all of the armies that there are, all the armies of heaven. He can marshal all the forces. He's the sovereign one. No one can stand up against him. You can't, no matter what you try to amass, you can't stand up against God. And so what God says will happen, he says, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. So there's going to be desolation. God's going to turn around what men had thought would bring prosperity. God's going to bring it to nothingness. He's going to bring it to emptiness, to desolation. And then on top of that, he's going to bring it to a lack of productivity. It says, for 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. These are measures that we're not familiar with, but what it's intended to communicate is that if you own this type of property, your expectation should be this type of productivity as to what would be raised and grown in that particular land. And God is going to cut it down to almost nothing. And you're going to be amazed at how unproductive. You're going to put in all the efforts and all the hard work and the labor, and then what you get out of it is so unproductive for what you have invested. And so 10 acres, that's the amount that 10 teams of oxen could plow in one day. The word is like 10 yokes or 10 acres. And so that land amount is, you know, how much could you expect to get out of what 10 teams of oxen could plow in one day? Well, it would be a lot more than one bath of wine. Apparently in the California Napa Valley, 1 acre yields about 120 gallons of wine. So 10 acres would yield about 1,200 gallons of wine. And here, in one bath of wine, maybe you have 6 to 12 gallons instead of 1,200 gallons. That's the type of contrast that the prophet is making here in terms of numbers, where he's just trying to shock you into how unproductive this situation ends up being. And ephah, he says it's like you get, you know, maybe you get one-tenth of what you were expecting or something like that or less. He says that's what it's going to yield. And so it's very unproductive. Turn over to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, where Christ gives the parable of the rich fool. And that's what we're dealing with back in Isaiah 5. Luke 12, Christ gives the parable of a man who had the same motivation of wanting to amass house to house and field to field. Luke 12, verse 11, verse 13, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But Jesus said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" And then he said to them, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed." The Lord gets back to the root issue that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and it's greed that's at the heart of this. He says, "For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." You misjudge things when you think that one more is going to be enough, that one more is going to somehow change my heart attitude and my condition, and that I'll be a different person, and I'll have different sense of satisfaction when I add this one more thing. Jesus says, no, that's not the case. So he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive. He began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. There I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" This is his security plan. His security is in these things, his expectation of the future. But God said to him, "You got it all wrong, you fool. This very night your soul is required of you. And now, who will own what you have prepared?" So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. The contrast that Jesus makes is the orientation of the heart towards, are you laying up treasure in heaven? Are you rich towards God? Are you concerned with God's program, what God wants accomplished? Do you want to serve him? Or are you trying to amass things where they're just going to rust and decay and thieves are going to break in and steal and destroy? And you're going to end up shocked that you have nothing at the end. And so there's this judgment that's spoken of here as God goes ahead and he and Jesus in Matthew 23, he had his own series of woes. You remember in Matthew 23, Jesus went woe after woe after woe against the Pharisees in similar parallel fashion to what Isaiah spoke here. And in verse 14 of chapter 23, Jesus says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses." You're making yourself rich at the expense of the less fortunate and those who cannot protect themselves, ones that you should be providing for. You're devouring their houses. For pretense you make long prayers, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. And so Christ himself condemns this perversion of possessions, where you have this materialistic mindset, where you even exploit others as you amass house to house and land to land at the exploitation of really your neighbors. Verses 11 to 17, back in Luke chapter 5, we move on to the second woe. This woe has to do with the perverters of pleasures. It starts out with judgment against those who are drunkards, who are intoxicated with strong drink. But really, it's not just oriented against their issue of excess in terms of drinking. It has to do with their sensual mentality, where they're seeking pleasure and self-indulgence, and they're addicted to pleasure and entertainment, and it manifests itself in addiction to the strong spirits here, but it manifests itself in other ways as well. So this one he develops quite at length, verses 11 to 17, probably gives the most exhaustive treatment to this particular one, and I think it's this particular one that probably speaks the most to our condition in the United States. I mean, certainly we're a materialistic culture. I mean, if you ask the countries around us what their impression is of the United States, probably one thing that comes to mind is the materialistic mindset that they feel that we have. But also, they would speak of our excesses when it comes to self-indulgence and pleasures and entertainment and just what we go after in the way of excesses here. So he says in verse 11, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them." So here on both sides of the day, they start out the day, they finish the day too early, really, and too late to show that their whole life is consumed with, how can I have a good time? What am I doing to get the most pleasure out of this particular moment? And to get that pleasure, to some degree, I have to escape the realities of certain aspects of life by immersing myself in things that give a false sense of reality, that take me away in an escapist type of sense and remove me from certain aspects of relationships that I have and of responsibilities that I have, and take me to this other dream world where I live in the context of entertainment and of lust and of what types of pleasures I can pursue. Certainly if you rise up early to drink, you're not going to be of much use in terms of productivity during the day. In terms of accomplishing what God wants you to do with your time, with your life, you're certainly not going to be investing yourself. Your mind is not going to be under control. You're not going to be able to marshal your resources and your physical energy in the direction that you should. You're basically living a wasted life. And that's the picture of these people here that have the wealth to invest in this. They can go out and buy, you know, what they want to indulge in. And so they are living with these wrong priorities. Just party animals. They're out clubbing from morning till night. They're out involved with hanging with a crowd that wants to do this. And they have no concern, no thought for the things of God. Again, I think of the message of Ecclesiastes. Some of the titles that, you know, when I studied through the book of Ecclesiastes a long time ago, some of the titles of that book that I thought through were, number one, "When you live for the pleasures of today, you're left with a handful of smoke." Think of those images of vanity and of emptiness and of what your life is apart from Christ, that under the sun, it's just emptiness when you strive for all of these things. "Fun under the sun equals none when life is done." Fun under the sun equals none when life is done. "Living it up will always let you down." These are messages that Solomon, who pursued this path, comes back and testifies to us, don't go down this path, is what Solomon's counsel is. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 1 to 2. This is Solomon saying to himself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. He's trying all different things. He tried materialism and possessions. He's already spoken of having tried that. Now he's going to try pleasure. He says, so enjoy yourself. And then he does that. And then he evaluates it at the end of the day. And he says, behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, any kind of entertainment, I said, it's madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? That's the testimony of Solomon. And he also testifies that, it's inappropriate to be drinking and feasting in the morning hours. Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 16 to 17. He says, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad. That speaks of the youthfulness that we looked at earlier in Isaiah as being almost a curse. When you have, instead of the elders, you have the youth in charge. He says, and whose princes feast in the morning. That's a judgment. That's an inappropriate thing that Solomon warns against. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility. Instead of just being a lad who doesn't have the experience, that doesn't have the capabilities. Blessed are you when you have the right kind of leadership and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. So that's the testimony that Solomon gives in contrast to what Isaiah is indicting the people for in their sensual overindulgence. So their banquets, it says, are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. And Isaiah is not saying that there's anything wrong with music or using musical instruments, or that there's anything wrong with feasting at the appropriate time. But he's saying if your life is given over to this, where it dulls your conscience and your sensibilities so that you have no focus on the things of God, so that your priorities are so overturned that this is what consumes your life, then you have a deep inward problem. And that's what he goes on when he speaks of the unintended consequence or what really is taking place. It's what's happening is the neglect of what really matters. While they are engaging in all of this, they're not devoting their focus on what's most important. So he says, but in contrast to where they're putting all their focus and attention, he says, but they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. That's our culture today. What do people care about God's program for today? The people that we mix with, throughout the day, what do they care about what God's trying to accomplish in this day and age? They have no thought of that. They've got no concern for that. Their thoughts are elsewhere. And how sad it is for the people of God when they know so much and have the light of God communicated to them, and yet in apostate fashion they turn away in their stubbornness and their rebellion. And what they really like is just pursuing the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, and that's what they go after. And that's what they really want instead of God's wisdom. So here this phrase, the work of the Lord, they don't pay any attention to the deeds of the Lord, to the work of his hands. I think this phrase, the work of the Lord, here it has a special emphasis on God's work of judgment. Psalm 46, verse 8. Come behold the works of the Lord. The same phrase. Come behold the works of the Lord. And then it specifies what kind of works we're talking about. Who has wrought desolations in the earth. Part of God's wonderful work. He has his work of redemption. He has his work of forgiveness and of cleansing and of blessing. But he also has his fearsome work of judgment, where he displays his holiness and his righteousness, and he displays his justice. And it's in this work of judgment that Isaiah has the emphasis, that here he is trying to speak to these people and raise the alarm, and by this series of woes gain their attention so that they turn from their sinful ways, and they are just as uninterested as the people were in Noah's day, who were out eating and drinking and involved in all their pleasures. And as Noah's warning them, hey, don't miss the boat. You better be on the ark, You don't want to miss this one. And they could they make fun of him. They just were mocking his preaching of righteousness to them, his denunciation of their sinful behavior, because their focus was on just all the revelry and all the party animal life that they were living. And so you remember from Hosea chapter 4, verse 6. As Isaiah goes on, and as he gives the judgment, he says, "Therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge." And that's what Hosea references in Hosea 4, 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. They don't have this interaction with God on a personal level where they're relating to God and they understand who He is and they know God personally and they're obedient to His will. Instead, Hosea says, "Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being my priest. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children." And that's the judgment that Isaiah speaks of back in our section here. He says, "Therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge. Their honorable men are famished. Their multitude is parched with thirst." So all of these consequences of famine and thirst and captivity into exile, these are the things that are coming upon God's people because of their failure to respond. He goes on and speaks of further judgment with this imagery of Sheol, of the place of the dead. He says, "Everything that you count as important and valuable and that you're boasting about in your party atmosphere, all of these things are going to be consumed." As Sheol, picture this monster Sheol, as it opens its mouth, it's going to devour all of you, and you're headed right down this wide path of destruction. You have neglected the narrow way of salvation, and instead you're streaming down this broad way unto destruction where Sheol opens its mouth and everything that you count as precious just pours right into this, and Sheol feeds its appetite. Your appetite that you're feeding now, Sheol is going to feed its appetite on you. So it says, "Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat." Picture that this image that he has here has opened its mouth without measure. "And Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her, they descend into it." And they're no more. They're gone. And so the result is that God has brought about his purposes of humbling man in order to exalt himself. So the common man will be humbled. It doesn't matter what kind of man you are, the common man or the man of importance. He'll be abased as well. It doesn't matter what your economic station is. It doesn't matter who you are. All of mankind will be humbled before God. The eyes of the proud also will be abased. Those eyes that are so arrogant, those eyes that have that look of contempt, the look of defiance, that look of, "You can't tell me what to do. I'm going to live the life how I want to live it." Those eyes that are so haughty and lifted up, God says those eyes of the proud also will be abased, no matter who it is. Those eyes that covet and go after what they want, those eyes that lust, those eyes, God says, he's going to abase and he's going to humble those in order that God would raise himself up. He says, "But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment." That's one of the supreme purposes of judgment, is in order that God might be raised up to be shown the majestic, holy, righteous God with standards that are universal, that are eternal, that are abiding. He establishes that. He says he'll be exalted in judgment. The holy God, the Holy One of Israel, his name there in the book of Isaiah, the Holy One of Israel, the holy God, he will show himself holy in righteousness. So this is what the people have to look forward to. They have refused to humble themselves, to bow the knee themselves before God. And now God is going to force them to bow their knee in a way that Sheol is going to devour them, and they're going to be completely humble. And then there's this aspect of, I'll call it replacement theology. You've got, now it says, "Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture." You amass all these lands so that you can have crops. They're not going to be your crops. And you've got nothing. You're desolate. You've got nothing. And now you've got these wild animals roaming around in a peaceful setting. And where you've been devoured, you've got these lambs grazing in these things that you thought you would own and enjoy. And strangers or foreigners will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 2, it speaks of a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet, God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. This is what's going to happen is, you don't determine who gets to enjoy these possessions or these pleasures that you went after, you're now going to find that somebody else is there eating in the waste places of the wealthy. So this aspect of perverters of pleasures, that's what Peter spoke about. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 to 10. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. That's what these people were doing. They're characterized by indulging the flesh in their corrupt desires. And God knows how to both rescue the godly, but he also knows how to reserve the wicked unto the day of judgment. And that's this second woe that God is delivering, that this day of judgment is coming soon. Then he gets a little more rapid here. This third one is probably the most mysterious of the six. He says, woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. I've called this one perverters of reverence. These are people that have no fear of God. These are people that, if you can picture them, their sin is very out there. It's very blatant. In fact, it's so attached to them that it's like they're hauling it behind them, as if it's a cart loaded down with their sin and iniquity, and they can't escape from it. In one sense, they're in bondage to it, but they also have it right out there defiantly in the open where all can see. And wherever they go, it goes with them. And it's just so connected to them that they're characterized by this sin and iniquity. And it's sinning with an open fist of defiance against God. And they're shown as ones that are, in essence, flaunting their sin. They're sinning presumptuously. This isn't out of ignorance. They're sinning with a high hand. They've chosen to engage in these sinful actions. And they end up, in verse 19, they end up in a position of mocking God. It's very sarcastic. The phraseology in verse 19 shows that what they're saying to Isaiah is, we hear you. All these promises of judgment and what God's going to do, show me. I don't believe a thing that you're saying. I'm having a good time. I don't know about you, Isaiah. I'm enjoying life. You know, I'm living life to the max. You know, you're the one that can't do this, and you say your God doesn't want you to do that. I don't have any restraints like that. I can do whatever my heart desires. So I've got it great. Who has it greater than me? You know, is what. So they're coming back with this tone of sarcasm and saying, I won't believe anything until I see it. You know, you say this judgment's about to happen, well, let it speed up. Why doesn't God speed things up and let's see it? I don't think there's any truth, any reality to what you're saying. This is just a bunch of false warning and fear that you're trying to foist off on me. I'm not buying any of it. Isn't that so much our culture today? Is people say, well, you know, you people, you're just trying to instill fear. You're just going about trying to bash us as if you want to be some Scrooge and keep me from enjoying my life. So I'm not going to hear any of it because there's no truth to it. I don't believe in it. And so they just mock God, just as in 2 Peter again, chapter 3, verses 3 to 4, when it speaks of the correspondence between the days of Noah and how they lived back then, what their attitude was back then, and the day right now. We're in the last days. We were in the last days then. Surely we're in the last days in the United States here, because this is exactly the mentality of the people we live with. It says, knowing this first of all, in the last days mockers will come with their mocking. These are the mockers in Isaiah chapter 5. They're following after their own lusts. That's what they're doing there, saying, where's the promise of his coming? You say he's coming back in judgment? You say there's going to be a second coming of Christ? I don't even believe in the first coming. I don't even know what that was about, but it doesn't have anything to do with me. And there is no second coming. Ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. God is not intervening in my life. There is no accountability, is the message. What the people are saying to Isaiah is, we refuse to acknowledge that we have any accountability before a holy and righteous God who will end up rendering judgment. And so he goes on in verse 20 and he rattles these off, the next woe, the perverters of values. It's a sad thing when a society turns everything upside down so that it's woe to those who call evil good and good evil. He says, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness. Who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. That's the age in which we live. We are spoken against. If we believe in disciplining our children appropriately and spanking our children as it's appropriate, it's turned around and it's called physical abuse. And it's, you know, going to be outlawed in various aspects. You know, the government is going to crack down on it more and more because the view of the government is, again, a perverted value system. They've twisted things around and they said, well, that's wrong. Just like now the marriage between people of the same sex, that's called, it's not just tolerated, it's promoted. It's saying we've got to teach those values to our kids in elementary school to make sure that they don't grow up with the prejudices and the bigotry of people in our generation who grew up with these biblical values. Let's make sure that from an early age we teach them that this is right and proper, and it's just an alternative choice that somebody's making, and it's completely something that should be exalted and should be given its due place in society. And instead of it being in the closet, they want to shove the Ten Commandments in the closet. They want to shove prayer into the closet. That's what they want to hide. They want out in the open all of these things that in our past history as a nation, there's no way that we would have tolerated given our understanding of biblical truth. Same thing with abortion, with contraception, funded, all supported by public funds. Shouldn't a woman have a right over her own body to make choices that involve murdering her unborn child? It's shocking, but people, that's what they say. They want this. We have it because people want this. It's the desire of their hearts not to have accountability. Shouldn't our teenagers have access to free contraceptives provided by public funds? I mean, they're going to engage in sex anyway. We might as well promote safe sex. There's no, you know, we can't, this business of abstinence before marriage, that's just a pipe dream, you know. There's no way we can stand on that. They've completely turned everything upside down because they want to eliminate all accountability. You know, it wasn't that long ago that the policy that we had towards drugs was just say no. Pretty soon the policy is, everything becomes legalized, you know. Marijuana is now legalized in different states. Pretty soon it's, you know, the government wants the revenue. They want the tax revenue from these things, and they don't want to try and deal with having to do the restraint aspect and having to do the punishment aspect, because they just are incapable of exercising that restraint and having good judicial practices and having the type of prohibition that's needed. And so we're just going along, and now we've turned everything upside down, and we're saying that good is evil and evil is good. Light versus darkness, etc. So we've lost our moral compass. When this happens, you've got no way to orient yourself. Where's due north anymore? Your compass doesn't work. Your conscience, it doesn't work because it's now misinformed with all of these other value systems. And so everything is now morally relativistic, and it's turned upside down. Van Paranak, I like, as I've mentioned before, in his Cyber Chapel site, he's done an excellent job in his exposition of Isaiah. He says, this kind of sophistry, calling good evil and evil good, he says, it's common in academic analysis of Scripture. It's particularly common in writings of the so-called Christian feminist and Christian gay. Can you imagine that? Christian feminist, Christian gay. Those things shouldn't even go together, you know, those phraseologies. But if you look at writings where they try to justify from Scriptures, that the Bible doesn't really say that. It says these things are common. It says these verses paint a perfect picture of the modern morality. These verses in Isaiah, it really corresponds with what's happening today in our modern morality, with its glossing over of evil, its redressing of wickedness to give it the appearance of righteousness. This insensitivity to moral decay is the sign of deepest corruption. Again, we've talked before, this is how far down the path, how far down the slide we are when these things give evidence to themselves in the culture. We've mentioned before the end of Romans chapter 1, where society degrades to the point that not only do they do these things that God before had called abominations, but they give hearty approval to those who practice these things. And so they've overturned the value system in that way. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 5 speaks of conditions in the last days. Realize this, in the last days, difficult times will come, and we're in difficult times. Our children are going to face difficult times. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious, gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Avoid such men as these. This is what Christ found when he came into the world. John 3:19. This is the judgment. Light has come into the world. Men loved the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. So they've exchanged. What they really want is darkness instead of light. Remember in Mark chapter 3, verses 22 to 29, the Pharisees there are attributing the miracles that Christ did to Beelzebub. They so turned things around that instead of attributing things to the Holy Spirit or attributing things to the power of God, they're attributing the works of compassion and of love and of mercy and the works that Christ performs. They said, well, he must have done these by the power of Satan. And that's how upside down things have become. So a society that's on the verge of experiencing God's severe judgment, it reflects all of these types of perversions, this rotten, stinking fruit, perverters of possessions, number one, perverters of pleasures, number two, perverters of reverence, number three, no fear of God, perverters of values, number four, now, number five, perverters of wisdom, verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Well, that's certainly true in the life of academia. If you look at sophisticated professors, you know, our world is all one of, we think we're so sophisticated. We think we're so above and beyond that we've grown beyond the Victorian days and the Puritan days and the days when people held to biblical truth. And in fact, those people who still believe those things are portrayed as, you're an ignoramus. You know, you're some unthinking, Bible-pounding, you know, guy who's just repeating something that was brainwashed into you when you were young. You don't know how to think for yourself critically. But if you have any type of sophistication in scholarly circles, you know, you would surely reject all of these things that have the element of the miraculous, that have the element of God intervening in man's history, that have the element of accountability before a holy God. All of these things would be anathema to those who are in these types of professional circles. I think of the media commentators, whether it's in a political realm or whatever realm it is in the social media and the entertainment media, they're so self-righteous. When you look at how they love to present exposés against, oh, how horrible this is and how horrible this is, and they come across with such a self-righteous type of a stance, as if in their conduct and if their life they're so far above this. And they, in their own eyes, you see, they're so wise, they think so highly of themselves and their own ability to judge and to discern what is right and wrong. Even comedians, you know, as they poke fun at everyone and everything and anybody, you know, they go ahead and set themselves up as ones who are wise in their own eyes. They're clever in their own sight. You know, we none of us were there at creation. And yet these sophisticated scientists of today, they want everyone to believe in some preposterous explanation. I mean, if you ever just stop to think what they're asking us to believe in, that, you know, you just add chance with enough time and crank enough time into the equation and you've got fish, you know, flapping their wings and somehow becoming birds, and you've got monkeys growing up to be humans. And you don't have any transitional links, and all the fossil evidence and whatever we say, you don't find any of these transitional links where there should be millions of years in which you have these transitional forms. And yet, despite that type of lack of evidence, they make it sound like such a scientific certainty in terms of this theory of evolution, that they have made the law of the land as such, where it's even, you know, in some locations, you know, be illegal to teach creationism, you know, because that would be some kind of backwards thinking, where from a scientific, sophisticated standpoint, because we're wise in our own eyes, we certainly don't want to contaminate the thinking of our young people with even the possibility of entertaining creationism as an option. And yet, where were they when God created the heavens and the earth? So this expression, wise in one's own eyes, it appears five times in Proverbs. First one is chapter 3, verse 7. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Instead, what's the opposite? Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. We need to humble ourselves and understand the difference between human wisdom and its limitations and God's wisdom and what He has revealed, because He is the one who knows. The problem is, when Christ was here speaking to the Pharisees, the problem is that you think so highly of yourselves that you're beyond salvation in some sense. You know, Christ said, I came to save the ones who are sick and know that they're sick and can at least respond to medicine and help. You know, but the ones that don't think they're sick, they're beyond help because they're not going to respond. Christ says to the Pharisees, if you were blind, you would have no sin. If you recognized blindness that you have, you can at least repent and respond and be forgiven. But since you say we see, since you deny the reality of your blindness and your sinfulness, then your sin remains. And you're just wise in your own eyes. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 18 to 21. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks that he is wise in this age, and that's what our people today think, he must become foolish, so that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God. For it is written, he is the one who catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the reasonings of the wise, that they are useless. So then let no one boast in men. And then he finishes up verses 22 to 23 with this final of the six perversions, this perversion of justice, this corruption of power. He ties it again to drunkenness. Drunkenness can probably flow through all of these, and that, you know, people are just consumed with this self-indulgent type of lifestyle. But it goes beyond drunkenness in this passage as he speaks to the impact that it has on those who are leaders, should be in a position of using their faculties of judgment to objectively distinguish between right and wrong, to protect the innocent, and to stand up against injustice. But instead, justice has been perverted, and these people will do anything for a bribe. It says, first of all, it says these people, they're champions of intoxication. It says, woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine. They're valiant men. He uses military terms here of heroic stature. He says they're viewed as valiant men in mixing strong drink. What a context in which to be viewed as a champion, in which to be viewed as a valiant, brave warrior. It's in the context here of you guys are your champions in the wrong venue. You know, you're known for the wrong thing. And it's in this age of intoxication. I think of the one TV commercial. I don't know if you know the series of commercials that revolves around this one alcohol advertisement, the most interesting man in the world. Can you picture that guy? I mean, he's this bearded, debonair gentleman. He's in his 70s or so, and he goes on and he does all of these dramatic feats, and he's able to do all of these things that are just, you know, how could he even do this? At the end of the advertisement, you know, I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer whatever it is, Dos Equis. And he ends with his sign-off, stay thirsty, my friends, you know. And he has all of these little quips, you know. If he were to punch you in the face, you would have to fight off the strong urge to thank him, you know. He can speak French in Russian, you know. You know, all these things that just, and he's made out to be this hero, this champion. It's exactly, to me, it's the perfect picture of what Isaiah is speaking of here. He's one who's viewed as being a hero in drinking wine. Wouldn't you like to be sophisticated like him? You know? Wouldn't you like to be viewed by other people as so interesting, the most interesting man in the world? And he's a champion, a valiant man in mixing strong drink. But here, the sad case as to how these people are living out their responsibilities in life. They're champions of injustice. They justify the wicked for a bribe. They take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 15. He who justifies the wicked, he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. The Lord doesn't like uneven scales and balances. He doesn't like one group of people being treated one way because of their economic status and another group of people being discriminated against because of some other condition. He doesn't like discrimination. He likes equality and justice and fairness. He especially supports the rights of those who are being exploited and who have injustice foisted off against them. And so these people are heroes and champions in
in the wrong sense. James chapter 5, verses 5 to 6. You have lived luxuriously on the earth. You've led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. And that's what these people were involved with. So Isaiah goes through, and we'll look at the end of chapter 5 next week, but I just wanted to mention that he doesn't stop with these six woes. He doesn't come across in this passage as a self-righteous man who thinks he is so far above his countrymen. Because actually in chapter 6, where we're introduced to the conversion of Isaiah, where he has that vision of the holiness of God, there's a seventh woe that he introduces in chapter 6. And where he says in verse 5, woe is me. He has the honesty and he has the wisdom from God to see God for who he is and to see himself for his sinfulness. He says, woe is me, for I am ruined. I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And so as we respond to this and ask our Lord, how should we live in such a society? We are called to bring the message that Noah bring to his generation and to preach righteousness. We're called to bring the message that Isaiah brought to his generation, and yet to do it not from a self-righteous platform, but to come as a forgiven sinner, to say, I know what it is to experience the grace and the forgiveness of God, because I am one with you in terms of a depraved heart. I am one with you in terms of deserving God's judgment and his wrath. And yet I'm here to speak of God's compassion and his love and his mercy and what he extends in his gospel because of the sacrifice of our Lord Jesus Christ, which we will celebrate this morning. Let's pray.